Welcome to the Wheel With It podcast with your host, Devin. At Wheel With It, we are dedicated to exploring DEI issues in a fair, balanced, and fun way. Let's get into the episode.
Hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of Wheel With It. And today, I mean, I can't even tell you all about the episode we have today. It is going to be amazing. Heavy, but amazing. Please welcome Kyle Hebert, and I'm going to let him tell you his story. So, Kyle, tell us about yourself. Take it away.
Absolutely. Devin, thank you for having me. This is truly a blessing and all honor to our great God, Lord Jesus Christ. And this story is all about his grace. Yes, my mess is his message. And just a little bit of where the mess began. I'm born and raised in Chalmette. To two awesome parents, my mom, Maybelle, who was born in 1927, and my dad was born, Johnny, Cajun name Ignis, was born in 1925. They had me in 1965, so I'm a 40-itis baby, they call that, and so I had the best of both worlds. My mom had me late in life, and I have a brother, well, who deceased, and we'll talk about that. He was born in 1955, so we were 10 years apart. Wasn't real close, but albeit I was born in a truly moral, not Christian family, one that gave me just about anything I wanted, and but mostly I had everything I needed, but really gave me anything I wanted. And my dad was a electrical engineer, and he could fix anything. He had a little motto, Devin, that he would say, "Oh, I can fix anything from a broken heart to the break of day." And this man literally could. Mother, a school teacher. And, my brother went on to be a truck driver after going to machinist school. And he even went to school to be a radiologist for x-ray technician. So I come from a really great moral family. My dad always listened to my mom. And in 1970, in this one particular incident, my daddy was remodeling the kitchen to get the house ready. My mom wanted to redo it for the holidays when family would come over. She would have, the kitchen would be fresh. And I was very close with my dad. My brother was more of a mama's boy. I was with my dad. Whenever my dad was working on a project, I was there with him. In 1970, of course, I was age 5. Learning everything, my dad had gone on. He was remodeling the kitchen, putting in new countertops, using a adhesive called Formica glue. Now, if anybody on here knows anything about Formica glue, there's two types. One, it's very flammable, which is the good, strong one. Then there's the non-flammable. Well, it was getting late at night. My dad was finishing up the countertops, and he had turned the hot water heater off, the floor furnace. And right where he was working, what he did was he left the pilot light on the gas stove. And I was actually sitting behind him playing with a truck, but I'm watching what my dad's doing. And all I can remember, Devin, was a flash. And it went off like a time bomb, but it knocked me to the ground. And my reflexes, I immediately ran out the house to the front porch. But what had happened, the glue ignited with the pilot light on the gas stove, and that air fume mixture caused inner combustion that blew the kitchen apart with me and my dad in it. But I got thrown on the floor and I ran out to the front. But when I got to the front, I realized that my dad wasn't with me. And thank God my mom was outside. I had a little Chihuahua Muncher that was sick. She was in the garage, and she was giving him some medicine to try to make him well. And this particular night, my brother was sleeping at one of his friends' homes. So it was just me and my dad inside the house. So naturally, wanting to be with my dad, I ran back inside. But Devin, as I'm running back inside, the house is on fire. My dad grabs the can of glue, which is inflamed, and he just throws it. had no idea where I was at. You know, he's reflexing. By this time, I'm running in. The glue hits the ceiling and lands on me. Well, I'm covered in glue, on fire now. I'm running around the house. I can remember going lay between the refrigerator and the deep freezer. I just went and laid down. And my mom, by this time, heard screaming, which wasn't unnatural because me and my dad played all the time. But when she smelled smoke, she knew this was serious. So she looked around the outside door to the back of the house, and the whole back of the house was in flames. So immediately she stopped what she was doing. She ran to the back door, grabbed some of the wrought iron lawn furniture from off the back deck, and beat the door down. My dad had been coming out. And later on, I would find out my dad told her, go find Kyle. He's in there. And my mom immediately, the love of a mother, ran into the flames, into the house. And my dad went outside, rolled in the grass, put himself out, grabbed a hose, came back inside, put the flames out. My mother found me in between the refrigerator and the deep freezer, and she literally, after numerous blankets caught fire and she couldn't suffocate the flames completely, my mother used her body to extinguish the flames on me. This was a horrific ordeal, whereas after we got finished with my dad putting the house out, my mom put me out, we went out on the front porch, and I can remember smelling my burned skin and burned hair, and I looked around as a little boy. I mean, I'm in shock, but they brought me immediately to Hotel Dew Hospital in New Orleans, whereas that at the time was the only hospital in Louisiana that had a burn unit. So I would wind up having to have a total of 46 major operations, and there was points where
how was that for a 5-year-old?
Oh my goodness. Horrific. Great question, Devin. It made me angry. I can remember blaming the doctors. And again, you know, I wasn't raised in a Christian home, so I didn't understand, you know, God. I didn't, you know, but the little knowledge I did have, you know, in my own 5-year-old mind, I blamed him. I got real vulgar with the nurses. I was really an angry young child that, you know, I had to go through physical therapy. My dad spent about eight months in the hospital. My mother was an outpatient, so my mom would, you know, house back together, and of course she had to get back to work, and then she was visiting us, and then my aunt and you know, her sisters and different family members, and even my school teacher from CF Raleigh School, she even was coming there and making sure I was, you know, as a kindergartner, just kind of keeping up, you know, with my studies and everything. And you know, they had to peel the skin off, and I had to have skin taken off my legs, and then I was in a wheelchair, you know, and then they pronounced me dead several times, and you know, I caught pneumonia. It was just a horrific ordeal that, and then the drugs, you know, they were using morphine to, you know, try to numb the pain and everything. So a lot of factors were working in this young boy that really didn't understand anything, and my family, you know, they just wanted the best for me and to get me back on my feet. And so, you know, that went on for, you know, almost, 2 years. You know, I was like a year and 8 months, year and 10 months, something, almost maybe right at 2 years. And then once I got out the hospital, we got a whole nother ordeal to deal with. I got to get back to school. So, but because burn victims, they can't be around germs. So I had to sit in a classroom by myself. So I just came out of all of this skin grafts and being angry and now put in the room. Now I got a bunch of kids gawking at me. And kids can be awful, you know, looking and calling me names and everything. So I can remember, Devin, the first time I was able to come out that that lone room. And, you know, the physical therapy really helped me. I come up out the wheelchair, regain my strength back, you know, so that was a process.
How
but I can remember
physical therapy, because I go through physical therapy and I'm not even a burn victim and it's painful. I can't even imagine if your skin
Right. Well said. It's work. You know, I mean, it's work, and you wanna do the best. And me being 5 years old and angry, you know, I'm just tired of people touching me. I'm tired of, you know, I'm tired, you know, and actually,
I get tired at 27. I can't even imagine.
You. Thank you so much for saying that. And you really get a really front row grasp of what I'm saying here, and that's precious. And so I did not act accordingly, Devin, to the children who was gawking at me and making fun of me. And I would get so angry. I can remember I would smell blood. And I unleashed one day on a particular kid who had called me a bad name. I don't remember what it was, but I snapped and I whooped him pretty good. It was the first time I had really put my hands on another human being. And I beat this kid up pretty good. The other kids...
Did he bother you again after that? I mean, not that you should do that, but did he bother you again?
No, right? No, ma'am. He didn't. No, absolutely no. But there was others that tried me, and I beat them down. And so I sort of got a rep for being a good fighter now. And so, you know, pride's welling up, and that's a bad mixture. Anger, pride, and now... there's consequences to that. Remember, my mom's a school teacher, so she knows everybody in the system. She's over at Chalmette High School. But she knows the teachers at my elementary school, and they, of course, give her a call and say, Kyle's fighting every day. And, we're going to have to, you know, discipline him. So my mom and dad decided to have this real long talk with me, like, you know, you can't do this. You know, this is not the right thing to do. We didn't raise you this way. So their remedy for this was sports. Now, again, I wasn't raised in a Christian home, so, you know, I just understood basic morals, right, wrong, at a very natural level, not spiritual. And so...
Me too. I had great parents, mm-hmm. but I'm not... they're not necessary. I mean, they're great people, but
absolutely,
they're not necessary Christians either. Right. So, yeah.
Same. Yes. Well said. Same boat here. And love them. I mean, and they did the best that they could, you know. I'm grateful for them, Devin. I had some wonderful parents. And we'll
I hit the lotto bit. With the parents. So,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. So they decided to welcome me, open up the possibilities if I wanted to play sports. And I did. I did. I enjoyed sports. You know, I had a little speed and I had some ability and a lot of toughness. And the doctor, my skin grab, Dr. Robert Mead, said, let it turn him loose. Turn him loose. He's going to be fine. And so in sixth grade, I began playing football for Chalmette Middle, the middle school, and began excelling. And I started on defense. I played some cornerback, and I wasn't real big, but I was fast and some safety. But the coach recognized that not only did I have speed, I had catching ability, and I was pretty smart, you know? I mean, I had some, even though the heat, you know, from the fire, the doctors thought that I would have cognitive problems. I didn't. Oh, they really thought I was going to stay in a wheelchair. I came out of the wheelchair. And by no means did I recognize who was really doing all this behind the scenes. I gave myself the credit. So they moved me to offense, and that's really where I began to be recognized. I started, you know, making some waves, some positive waves out there, you know, on the football field, and running the ball, getting some good yardage, and my team started winning. We got some key players on the team. And what really happened, Devin, was that my grades began to get better because you got to keep a certain grade point average. And then I stopped fighting because you can't be – if I want to play football, I got to stay out the front office. So really the decision my mom and dad made was bigger than what they thought. So I wound up going to Chalmette High, exactly where my mom's working at. And that's a pretty big football school. You see the Friday Night Lights, you know, on TV, or, you know, that story of that. Well, I was an owl. Being a Chalmette owl was a big thing because they played 11 quad A, 4As, but they're the only public school in the Catholic school league. That's a big thing. We play against like Rummel, Jesuit, Brother Martin, St. Aug, Holy Cross, you know, all these big Catholic schools. And I wound up making the varsity as a freshman. I didn't start, but my opportunity came where I could get in and play, and coach began putting me on punt teams and whatnot. And I'm going to tell you, Devin, my grades, I was making the grade. I was taking all the classes that I needed. I started looking at the goal. I wanted to go to college. I wanted to get into forestry. And I'm looking around at some of the colleges here, and I'm playing football and breaking some rushing records and some touchdown records. I had really a wonderful run through Chalmette High School and all the way to 1983, where my senior year comes, and I'm not fighting anymore. I'm living a real moral, studious life, but I'm doing it all for myself, and I'm making my parents happy, and football team's looking good, my peers, I got a lot of friends and everything, and, you know, I'm living a really good moral life. Well, in 1983, last game of the season, we playing, it was St. Aug, and we had an opportunity to play them in the Superdome, and I'll never forget, you know, all through my practices and football games, I never will ever forget the times, you know, my dad never missed a practice, Devin. My dad became the heart and soul of my life. And my dad was my best friend. He was my mentor. He would always he poured his life into me. You know, he taught me various vocational skills. And he was at every practice. My friends loved my dad. My friends loved my mom. My mom was great people, worked at the school. But my dad was a very special human being. And he really, lived an amazing moral life in raising his two sons. You know, I played football. My brother played in a band. And then my brother would go on to, machinist school and x-ray technician school. And then ultimately he'd drive a truck. But my dad supported him in all of that and poured his life into me. But every time a football game or a practice, I could look in the stands. My dad was there. And it was an amazing, I never realized how important that was and how great of a mentor this man became to me. Not a Christian, but a good moral mentor pouring his life into his son. And the last game of the season, Devin, against St. Aug, for the first time we beat St. Aug, and it was in the Superdome. And I'll never forget my dad's, you know, he was so happy. And that was the night that we began really talking about my future and going to college. And I had actually received a scholarship from UL, a little smaller college here in Louisiana. I wasn't big enough to play for LSU. You know, I could have went to Southeastern or one of these smaller colleges, but I chose UL and even went and visited on campus because I wanted forestry. Forestry is a wonderful program here in Louisiana, and UL has one of the best. So, you know, all of that's in place, and, you know, we beat St. Aug, and that's kind of like the icing on the cake for my high school football career, fixing to move on to the next chapter. And, you know, we go home that night, you know, and we all celebrate and everything. And me and my brother, we go to sleep. My brother and I had rooms across from one another. You know, Devin, I never heard. If my parents argue, I didn't know about it. They was very discreet about that. I'm sure they did. You know,
same thing as me. Like, I only remember them arguing one time when I was 19. Like, and if they did, I never heard about it.
My goodness. Yes. Oh, my goodness. You know, they got along. They worked together. You know, they both had full-time jobs. They raised these two boys. And, you know, they owned a washeterian, a grocery store. And that was when my dad was going to retire and work. You know, he was going to run his grocery store. But, Devin, this particular night, right after the football game, you know, I'm heading to UL, fixing to graduate. I had a 4.0 grade point average. I was keeping straight A's. You know, I really had turned the corner, you know, and wanted to do right. And for the first time, I heard my mom yelling. I mean, yelling. It was like, woke me up. Man, I come running out of my room. My brother's already out in the hallway. And I'm like, what's going on? He's like, I don't know. And we run to the back there. My daddy had closed in, me and my dad, we closed in a two-car garage and made their bedroom. It was gorgeous, Devin. They had their own room in the back of the house, bathroom and walk-in closet. I mean, it was sharp. And so we ran to the back of the house. My mama's coming forward. Daddy's dead, hollering. Daddy's dead. I didn't even click yet. Daddy's dead. Man, sure enough, I went in the room and I witnessed my dad. I mean, already pale. He wound up having a heart attack in his sleep, died in his sleep.
Sorry to hear that.
It was hard. Thank you. You know, that was the turning point. My life just flashed before my eyes, and here's my hero dead. And I, you know, all that anger that I had when I was in the hospital as a little boy came back 10 times more. And I wound up leaving home. You know, I'm really hating this guy that I don't know. I didn't know. Blamed him. Even blamed my mom. Blamed my brother. Blamed everybody. Blamed myself. And here I am, a 17-year-old. You know, I would finish school. I did, just because I didn't want to. I walked. I graduated. You know, I had lost my 4.0, but I did have enough GPA. I think I wound up with a 3.6, and I graduated with the
role. Which is amazing. I mean.
Thank you. Hurt. A lot of pain. Didn't know how to handle the pain. Not a Christian. You know, I didn't run to the right place. But what I did run to, Devin, is here where it gets really ugly. I saw drinking, drugging. The athletes that I used to hang with who had plans and, you know, wanted to go to college and, you know, have a life and build families. I threw all that away. I didn't want anything to do with that. I just wanted to get loaded, wanted to fight. And I'm getting involved with a couple of biker gangs and that was not good. I mean, and they, you know, really they enhanced my drinking and my drugging and sexual immorality. And, you know, I used up a lot of females, and I'm so sorry, because I'm gonna tell you, you know, every time I have an opportunity, you know, I apologize to women for the way that I treated y'all, because y'all was created to be valued and honored and respected. And I did none of that, you know, during this downward spiral and debauchery and hellbound and fighting and hurting people. And that was crazy. Here I am, born and raised in Chalmette, and I got a lot of friends from New Orleans. I got a lot of black friends. But I'm going to tell you, I got a lot of Mexican and Cuban, you know, friends, you know. But I'm going to tell you, they didn't turn their back on me. They knew. It was amazing. That's a whole nother story.
Yeah. Yeah.
We really didn't get to that point. This is a wonderful time for me to, you know, really, my mess is now his message. But, you know, this would work. But however, my mess,
yeah, it is a part
I'm no longer this. This really shows the power of God in changing. And I got, you know, I jumped too far ahead, but, you know, where I work today and all of this shows the power of God, you know. But the beauty of it is that when I do begin to speak, it's like, whoa, You know, it's grace, and I've been there, and this is the mess right here that we're getting into. So from age 17, this is crazy, Devin, to 34. You know, I'm doing a life sentence on the installment plan. You know, I accumulate. It's crazy.
Yeah, I'm very passionate about criminal justice reform, as you know. So
yes,
I think I have a dark sense of humor. I laughed when you said that on Lisa's podcast. Okay.
Yes. I accumulated 97 arrests, you know, and 4 felony convictions. And look, I'm in and out, you know, people, and I'm blind. A natural man has not received the things of the spirit, for to him it is foolishness. And I'm sure there were people that was really trying to get my attention. But, you know, God is the one that gives the increase. He uses people to share his message. I wasn't mean to the Christian. I wasn't mean to the evangelist. And I wasn't mean to someone trying to share grace with me. I just didn't want anything to do with it. I had my own agenda. I wasn't, you know, I was dead in my trespasses. I was blind. And, you know, I was still blaming everybody. So I'm in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out. And this one particular incarceration in 1990, the early part of 99, I meet a girl while incarcerated, and we both get out, and I wind up bringing her home, and we move in with my mom and my aunt, and both of us have a very serious alcohol drug problem. You know, I've done acid, crack, meth, PCP.
So you've done everything.
Everything except put a needle in my arm. And had I'm sure, Devin, I would have liked it, but it would have killed me. There's no doubt. God was saving me for something.
You would have died, I think.
No doubt. Yeah. I'd have been in hell. So I just. By his grace, I didn't put a needle in my arm. And look, I'm not afraid of needles. You know, I'm being a burn victim. I had a lot of needles. Matter of fact, you know, on they did so many of the skin grafts that I was sharing with you that they had to begin doing skin grafts localized, which meant that I had to be awake for some of them. So, I got to watch and witness Dr. Robert Mead taking skin off my legs and flapping it and cutting it and then putting it on my body.
I have a pretty strong stomach for medical stuff, but that sounds
My goodness. Yes. Yeah. It's so I got to witness. So needles, it was truly the grace of God protecting me in my foolishness. So me and Susan, and that's her name, we drinking and we're living with my mom and my aunt, and it's just not going well. But my mom loved me so much, as well as my aunt. They wanted me close to home. So they agreed, let me and Susan stay there. And Susan would help, you know, with them and everything. But one particular night, Susan and I got in a very, very bad argument. And it involved my aunt getting in the mix of it. And I wound up beating up Susan and my aunt. And that was the charge. I got attempt first degree murder for beating up my aunt.
So you didn't intend to kill her, is that correct?
No.
Okay.
No.
But they bumped it up anyways because of your previous history. Okay.
Yeah, that and her age. My aunt was 72 years old. There's a clause in Louisiana. Yeah, and there, I mean, I was not raised to beat women up, but that became a part of my life. Every girlfriend that I had, I put my hands on. And they would stay with, I mean, I was a very abusive, derelict, foolish, ungodly, and no man is to put their hands on a woman. I was not, I never ever, like I said, I never saw my dad, you know, and I even, you know, I wound up conceiving, one of my girlfriends before Susan. I don't want to sidestep this because this is a very important piece here, is that I have a daughter, Kaylin, who's now 30 years old today. that I was never a part of her life. And she's taken the brunt of my downward spiral, my adulterous, my demonic, my drug addicting, my self-centered life. And this precious young lady has went through it all, and today still doesn't speak with me, and I get it. Yeah, do I desire reconciliation with my daughter? Yes. Do I deserve it? No. You know, but Kaylin, you know, she decides, even today, she still does not speak with me. But that's, you know, she was born, you know, in the 90s, and I trampled her love, and I was not a father to her. So, you know, and I'm in and out of prison, and I don't blame any of that. Here I get with Susan, bring her home, and then I beat my aunt up. And my aunt, the police aren't called, Devin. The police were never called for this charge. We had went like 2 weeks living as a normal family, me drinking and drugging. And one afternoon, I'm going back to school. I'm working for the local 11 sheet metal union. Remember I told you, my dad raised me on my tools.
Sorry about that. The phone is going off. So
can't even hear it.
Okay.
No, it's perfect.
Some of these mics are finicky, so I don't know what you can hear and what you can't, so.
No, it's perfect. No, that I didn't even hear that. But anyway, thank you for telling me.
Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, so, you know, the police didn't come, you know, when I committed this self-centered, abusive act on my aunt and Susan. We went on living, you know, like nothing happened. Me and Susan continually drinking. I'm going to school for the local 11 sheet metal union, and I'm finishing up that. I want to further my education with underwater welding. So I was going to night class like 3 days a week. And on this particular night, I'm coming back home from school, pulling in the driveway, and I see police cars all over the place. And I'm like, here, in my self-centered mindset, I'm like, somebody's in trouble. I don't even think about me. You know, 2 weeks ago, I just beat up my 72-year-old aunt and this poor young lady, Susan, which she had taken many beatings from me at the hands of this devil. And I pull in the driveway, and all I heard was guns. I mean, it was serious.
I mean, I know you work for the police now. I mean, yeah. I love the police. I support the police. My dad worked with a lot of police for his job because he was in loss prevention. So he was a security officer for department stores, basically. So he worked with a lot of police. So I'm not saying they did anything wrong. And I love them. But when I heard this on Lisa's podcast, mm-hmm. I was surprised because from what I've seen, and I don't know anything really about policing or protocol or whatever, but they usually wait to see if you become violent before they even think about doing that. Were you surprised?
Yes and no, and that is a great observation. Let me, that is beautiful. I live in Chalmette. We all know each other. It's a small town. I was the football hero. You know, they knew I had gone wild. They knew that I was drinking and drugging. But the very police that arrested me was the very ones I had went to school with, played football with. I'm telling you, my friends went on to be successful in the world's eyes. And they would always try to help me. They gave me chances. I mean, chance after chance. You know, there was times I would get loaded and I would call the police department and I'd tell them, send your best. And we would just have these free-for-all fights. And they would send the police over to fight me. And, you know, they would get, you know, strict orders from the sheriff not to kill me, but just to bring me in. And they would use that as training, you know, to arrest me. So they knew, you know, that number one, as mean and foolish and stupid and demonic as I wasn't one that carried weapons. I just didn't, Devin. I mean, I've never been into guns. And thank God.
I mean, I don't have any problem with people responsibly owning guns, but I've never been into guns either.
Right. So. No, I'm a felon, I'm a five-time felon because, of course, the attempt first-degree murder charge on my aunt. But no, I am truly pro-gun, pro-life, all of that. I love the Lord. But it's been an amazing journey to get me there. And so the arrest was another changing point in my life. When the handcuffs went on me and I was placed in the back seat of the police car, a peace came over me. Like a wild animal who had been caught, and it was like, and not being trapped, but I was at peace, Devin, and I couldn't understand exactly what was going on. And I can remember looking out the back window of the police car, and I saw the house, and I said, "I'm never coming back here." But I was okay with that. But I asked the police if I could see my mom and my aunt, and they told me no. And so I would never get, from that day forward, I've never seen my parents again, or my aunt, of course, or Susan. My mom and my aunt has passed away since then, and I had no idea where Susan went. But when they brought me in to the police station to, give me my rights and get all my paperwork and what I was charged with, and the cell door shut, it actually went off like a church bell. Something began to work in my heart immediately. Now, I didn't understand any of this, but what was happening was God had been opening up my heart and my eyes, and I no longer wanted to blame. Now, I hadn't even opened up a Bible yet, but this, I was broken is what it was. Man, something happened when I beat my aunt up. It was like, I had beat a lot of people up, but when I beat this woman up, I was broken, and I was sick and tired of being sick and tired of getting loaded. And when they put me, I come out, after you come out the holding cell, they put me in the back.
And back of the jail.
The jail. Right. Yes, ma'am. Great word. Yes. They put me on the tier. And so while I'm back there, I'm detoxing, and now I'm recognizing there's guys around me that are wanting to pray with me and, talk to me. And, I wasn't too to the prayer, but it was a slow process. Guys were bringing me the Bible, and they begin to minister to me, and we begin talking through some things, and then I begin to kind of pray by myself, and as best as I knew how. And I'm saying I decided, but there's no doubt that it was the hand of the Lord. I decided to take full responsibility for everything. So when I went to, I went through the arraignment, and then I went to my first court hearing, which was like 4 months down the road. I asked Judge Garvey if I could, just go ahead, let's get rid of it. Let's get over with. I don't want my aunt and my mom to have to be dragged through this. I'm fully guilty. I take full responsibility. Susan, she did not deserve any of this. I said, surely my mother didn't deserve any of this. My aunt didn't, she took the brunt of it. And my mama had to watch me, she saw me beating her sister up. And, that was horrific for her. And all I wanted to do was be responsible. I had here I went from blaming everyone to, being self-centered to now thinking of others. And didn't understand all that, but I wanted to do the right thing, Devin. So Judge Garvey, I said, look, I'm not making no deals. I don't want a deal. I told him, I said, I just want to do the right thing. So I pled guilty to 40 years at age 34. So from 17 to 34, running crazy. And then at 34, I begin to wake up.
Dang, that must have felt. How did that feel knowing you were going to spend 40 years?
I was free. I was free. Didn't understand all of it. It was, and I didn't realize how free I would get, because this next piece of the story, it validates everything I've been through, good, the bad, and the ugly, this great sovereign God and placing me and preparing me to walk into, which would be the next chapter, the land of new beginnings. of my life. And, you know, once I pled guilty, I accepted the 40 years peacefully, respectfully, and fully, responsibly, they would send me to Hunt. Hunt is the administrative unit of the Department of Corrections here in Louisiana, where they will send the convicted inmate and distribute them based on cognitive skills, vocational skills, mental health, age, charge, into the various prisons in the system. There's several. Angola being a lifers camp. That's where they send LIFE. I had 40 years, 34 years old. I could have stayed at Hunt, DCI, WCI. I wouldn't have went to Wade. Wade is more of a disciplinary cell block camp. But when the guard came by after 8 days of going through all these tests and everything, he tells me, "Mr. Abe, you're going to the Louisiana State Penitentiary, Angola." And I was like, wow. And for the first time, the gentleman next to me, who hadn't said a word to me the whole time, Devin, I heard him say, "Hey, man, you're going to the best place that anyone could ever go to do time." Now, I hadn't heard about Angola, you know.
Now, he been to Angola before? Is that how he knew that?
That's a great question. Nobody's ever asked me that. And so that is one. I'd have to say probably yes. Or knew someone. Now, I knew guys that had went to Angola, but we didn't talk about it in that respect. It was the bloodiest, you know. You could go up there and get whatever you wanted, you know. Live a life. It's a lifers camp. It was anything but the land of new beginnings. You know, guards getting killed by inmates, and inmates killing and raping each other, and it was all of that. But again, here we're talking about, you know, the overall picture of my story, God's sovereignty. This great holy God working all things together for his good through the good, the bad, and the ugly. And now I got this 40-year sentence, and I'm heading to the Louisiana State Penitentiary. That is a lifers camp, you know, where they got people who are going there to die. And nobody's ever leaving there. But I got a outdate of 2034, which is not impossible to make, but it is a long sentence that I took happily, respectfully, peacefully, responsibly. But next day, load up in the bus. We head down Highway 61, and and we pull up at the front gate, and it was, you know, I on the way up there, there was a peace. You know, there was no, woe is me, why did I take these 40 years? Nothing. That has never crossed my mind. And, I heard the guys that was in the bus with me, what they were talking about, but I'm in my own small understanding of prayer at this time, you know, and my little bit of knowledge of, you know, what I've gleaned the Bible while I was, you know, on the tier in St. Bernard. I knew this much, that there was something bigger than me in control of me and controlling situations and making a way and giving me a peace that was beyond my understanding. And when I pulled up at the front gate, no doubt, the hand of God pushed my head to look through the bars on the bus, and I could see in the distance, Devin, a sign. And what it was
now, this a big is old... This is crazy. This is the craziest thing I've ever heard. Tell us what the sign said.
The land of new beginnings. Talk about an oxymoron for this place. The land of new beginnings. And I'm like, really? You know, but oh my goodness, Devin.
So how long had that sign been there? Like, had they just put it up or something?
That is a great question. You know, in 19, I would have to believe You know, this is 2000 now. You know, I'm in 2000. I got arrested August 19th of 1999. 8 months. I'm in Angola. 2000 now. Early 2000. Warden Burrow Kane, who everybody, you know, he's one of the most famous wardens that has ever worked at Angola, because, you know, he's the one that God really used to turn the place around, and just a real simple, you know, no-nonsense man that treated us with the utmost respect and ran his prison, you know, with the motto, there's one bull in the pasture. But he coined the phrase moral rehabilitation. He believed that prison was for predators and monsters and not dying men. And that's his motto. I believe in 1994 that sign went up. That's to answer your question, because that's when Warden Kane got there. 94, 95, he brought in the Bible College and the New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary. And then in 2000, brings in this Cuban named Manny Mill, who was a prisoner that was locked up with Chuck Colson. Chuck Colson is Nixon's and for Watergate. And, you know, Chuck Colson is the one that created prison ministry, the big worldwide ministry that still, you know, goes and helps inmates. And I didn't know any of this. So here's the land of new beginnings. And let me tell you, it would become, no question, above the land of new beginnings for Kyle Hebert, because immediately, I mean, I'm telling you, immediately when I landed in Angola, remember, I was working for the Local 11 Sheet Metal Union, billing ductwork, and I was going back to school for underwater welding, and my dad, who was an engineer, had trained me, you know, in various trades, electrical, air condition, you know, I could build anything and fix any, you know, I got as good. And my uncle owned Hebert Alignment. I had a real good, I had 5 ASC certifications, so I love to work on motors and build cars. And, you know, only thing I couldn't do is paint, you know, but I could do basic body work. I had a cousin that painted, but I was real handy. You know, God had been using all of that. And here I landed into the land of new beginnings. And Warden Kane is building his first chapel. He had a vision. He wanted to put a chapel in every camp. Angola's 18,000 acres, and they have all these different camps. You know, you got Camp C, Camp D, Camp J, Camp F, Main Prison, East Yard, West Yard. You know, it's a city.
Yeah, I have to say that my mom was very nervous today when I told her I was interviewing somebody that had done 22 years at Angola.
Right.
And is there any thing that we should know about Angola that we wouldn't necessarily know?
Absolutely. At one time, everything I said is, you know, it's true. It was the bloodiest prison. It was the worst prison, and people were dying. People were getting raped every day. And then, you know, here comes Warden Kane. And, you know, the feds had to come in. You know, they had to, you know, take over. But God had been there working. And, you know, God works through people. And he worked through Warden Kane. And it still is the bloodiest prison. The difference is it's covered by the blood of Jesus, not the blood of humans.
Well said.
Yes, and I was privileged to be a part of that. And it became a little bit of heaven on earth for Kyle Hebert. But, well, you know, when that first day that I landed there, the individual, God is sovereign, that was putting in the ductwork in Warden Kane, his first project of this chapel at Camp D, gets a stroke. So they need someone to come in. Inmates do all the work. The trustees, they do everything from building to plumbing to roads to taking care of the cattle, to maintenance and everything. And so the inmates are building this chapel. And so Warden Vinoy and Warden Kane are looking for someone to be able to replace the individual that was doing the air-conditioned duct work. And here I come in as a brand new, fresh AU right off the press that has all this vocational skills, particularly come out the local 11 sheet metal unit and doesn't have a life sentence. And I'm 34 years old. So Warden Benoit calls me to the A building, which is where, you know, we meet at, and asked me, you know, would I be interested in, you know, asked me a few questions about my experience, and then says, would you be interested in helping us with the chapel? It'd be an opportunity for you to have a job and not go in the field. Because every inmate that comes off the bus, you got to go pick vegetables. Because Angola is a farm. We do all the picking of the crops, you know. We
I didn't know that. So I heard you say it on a...
Not only did I not do a day in the field, I went to work that next day at Camp D. They gave me a ride, and I was working with nothing but trustees. And in my area was a gentleman by the name of Ronald Edison, who happened, God is sovereign, be a pastor who had fallen, had lived in Slidell, and was real
proficient
in the
word. Which is crazy, by the way. Yeah. I mean...
Yeah. In the chat. He's the janitor cleaning up my area. I got a, you know, I asked for a coffee pot. I wanted some community coffee. My boss made a way for that.
I love the fact that they were like, what do you need? You're like, I need coffee.
Yeah, coffee. And they do that. You know, they will, you know, Angola is a, they allow a, you know, a lifer to live a life. And, you know, some of the perks for the trustees, you can have a coffee pot. You know, you can, you know, you can drink coffee. And, they, you know, the bosses, they'll take care of that. I mean, it's a small, you know, it's just a respect thing. You know, there's a lot of respect for the inmates and for the, you know, especially the trustees. And, you know, it's really healthy. And Warden Kane wanted that. So Ronald Edison wants to, you know, drink coffee with me, but it was truly the hand of God that, you know, Ronald wants to do more than that. He wants to begin praying with me and opening up the Bible with me. And, you know, this man here began pouring his life, doing breaks. You know, we putting in the duck work, and, you know, I got all the tools that I needed. I got a break. I got, you know, the various things I needed to build the ducks. And, you know, I was able to read the blueprints and get everything going smooth. And then during our spare time, Ronald would teach me the Bible. And then he would even begin, you know, bringing me to church and to a Bible study called Experience in God by Henry Blackaby. That would later on become the prerequisite for me to go to the New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary. Had no idea. And then Warden Vinoy would come, and he would give me my Class A trustee status, which meant now record setting, you know, usually takes 10 years to get a trustee status. In 2 weeks, you know, I had my full Class A trustee status. He took a chance on me. And, you know, after we finished the chapel, before I left, I made this comment to God. And I said, you know, you've got me building your house. The next thing you're going to have is me preaching in it. You know, so be careful with you. What comments
God,
you make to God.
That's crazy, though. Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah. So, you know, we would finish the chapel, and it went really well, you know, and I was getting a biblical education and understanding relationship. And for the first time, Ephesians chapter 2 jumps off the page, you know, the God of this world loved me. And it was at that point, there's no doubt, that the Lord removed the heart of stone, replaced it with a heart of flesh. And it was right there with Ronald Edison in that chapel that we was building. And Miss Lisa said it like this. She says, you know, Kyle, look at this. The Lord redeemed you with a broken pastor in a chapel at the lowest point of your life, in a prison that the world would see as the worst place. And yeah, it is. It is. But however, God used all of that to break you and to redeem you, to save you right there. And then my life would never be the same, because that was the springboard, you know, that I would learn later that was the whole time God, you know, he was there in the fire. He was there when I was running touchdowns. He was there in the fight, and he was there when I was running touchdowns. He was there when my dad died. He was there when I was drugging. He was there when I was, drinking and drugging and fighting. He was there when I beat up my aunt. He was there in St. Bernard Parish. He was there in that bus ride. He was there when I went through those front gates. He was there now in this chapel. And now I would be able to get a regular job in maintenance, and that job would allow me to be the maintenance man at the seminary in the main prison.
So now I'm the maintenance man. Which is crazy. We need a crazy counter on this podcast, because I've said crazy like 3 times.
This is truly all God in my mess. And then here's the big piece. I get a letter in the mail, and I had hurt my family, and rightly so. They had walked away from me. They were tired of me, and I deserved that. And I, we're forgiven of our sin, but there's consequences. And one of the main consequences, of course, Kaylin, my daughter, doesn't speak to me today. My family, most of them, don't either. But I have done that. I am not the drugs, not the alcohol, I'm the problem. And that's why Jesus died for me and to redeem me from all of that. But there's consequences to my sin. So I get a letter in the mail, and I'm not writing anybody. I'm not getting any money in. I'm working and I'm studying the word, and it's just me and God. And this letter, I open it, and me and Ronald Edison standing there, and a pitcher falls out and hits the ground. Well, Ronald picks it up, and he's looking at it, and I'm looking at the letter, and I see Melissa. I don't remember a Melissa, Devin. It's really terrible that I don't. I mean, that's how drug induced and how much of a monster I am, and that I was, of course. And it's only by His grace that I'm not a monster today. But I don't remember Melissa. It does not ring a bell. But Ronald says, hey, man, you got to look at this picture. So it's a beautiful baby boy. And I turn it on the back. And on the back, it says, hello, daddy, three-week-old Matthew. I had a son. In August, when I got arrested in August, so in March, April, I go to spring break. Now, remember, I told you I had a girlfriend, Susan, that I was living with. But yet I go to spring break and fool around on her. And I get a girl. I meet a girl while at spring break. Her name's Melissa. I don't remember her name. And we have a one-night stand. And Matthew is conceived. And I leave. And I come back to Louisiana, and I get arrested on this charge, very rightly so. Melissa, who is separated from her husband, is fooling around on him with me, one night stand, goes back home, gets back with her husband, and pregnant with my baby. Now, in a world of abortion, and that wants to kill the baby, let's eliminate the problem, they decide to keep the baby. But not only keep the baby, allow me to be a part of the baby's life. And they're not Christian.
Which is crazy.
Yes. Yes. So that God is sovereign. You remember, God's the one in control here. He's the one who turns the heart of the king whichever way, like rivers of water. Man's plans are thwarted. But God's plans will always come to fruition. It's amazing. Yeah, so I get the letter. And remember, my dad and me were close. And so let me tell you, everything began to flood back with me and my dad. And, I began to, how I'm going to raise this kid. But then peace came over me, Devin. And everything I had been learning in the Word and everything I had been studying, I knew that this was just the perfect time for me to be the prophet, priest, and king, all the offices that Jesus Christ fulfilled. It was time for me to be a good earthly steward and point my son to his real father, Jesus Christ, God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit, and to me to raise him in the word. And so I did. So through letters, and the Lord made a way that he put people in my life, you know, that would help me with that and financially assist me with phone calls. And then he sent a church called Riverside Baptist Church, where it is the church I'm on staff with today, with Larry Hubbard. And him and his team would come to Angola, and we would do Tuesday night Bible studies. So while I'm doing that, I get accepted into the Bible college, and there goes my seminary run now. And I get my bachelor's degree in Christian ministry, and then I continue, and I wind up getting my Master of Divinity through the seminary, and going to this Bible study and getting connected with people out here on the street, and of course Manny Mill, the Cuban, who brings in Awana, you know, which I know you're from, you know, that's a ministry that allows us by Art Roham, it's for children. And they memorize scripture, and, you know, they do all kind of little Bible studies and everything. But Manny Mill talks to Warden Kane and says, well, what about the children of the inmates? And Warden Kane said, I think, you know, man, we need to do something because we don't want no more victims. You know, if we raise children in the admonition of the Lord, that's one less victim, because it really is about victims. You know, people have been hurt. I've got victims. I've caused a lot of victims. And let me tell you, the Lord has made a way over the years that I've been able to reconcile with a lot of my victims. Not all of them, but he's made a way. He's restored, man, massively what the cankerworm has destroyed. And he is the great reconciler and giving me the ministry of reconciliation. So Manny's like, man, we need to bring Awana. Let's bring Awana in, and we're going to have a program called Returning Hearts, which is based on Malachi 4:6, turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, the hearts of the children to the father. And so we spent the all day event. You can pull this up on Google. We have Returning Hearts, and that was the first time the churches all came together, and they went to Florida to pick my son up, and I got to spend a day for the first time when Matthew was 9 years old, and I got to hear him call me daddy, and I got to apologize to my son for the first time, and just flat-footed tell him that I love him. And so we got to do that, and I was able to spend that whole day with my son. So that gets done. I'm in Bible college, and then you know, I get my Master of Divinity. I'm raising my son, and then Warden Kane opens up the door for those who graduate from Bible college.
Now, how did you meet Lisa and all this? Sorry.
that is a miracle too. I meet Miss Natalie Laborde, who is number two in Department of Corrections. Miss Natalie was originally on staff with Hillsong Church, and she wound up leaving that. And she came, you know, she's born and raised here in Louisiana, and they hire her with Prison Enterprise. Well, when the governors changed, she got moved from Prison Enterprise to Department of Corrections, second in charge with Secretary LeBlanc. Well, Miss Natalie loves Jesus. But the blessing was, I got to meet Miss Natalie, and I had no idea that who Miss Natalie was. And so we connected, and every time, you know, and then me and her brother became really great friends while I was incarcerated, Thomas. And that relationship, you know, of course, you know, it was on a very professional level, you know. But as a sister in Christ, you know, not only me, but she, you know, she looked out for all the men and the women, you know, at the women's prison. That's how I met Miss Lisa, because every time Miss Natalie would bring a guest, she would, you know, come get me, and I would speak like I'm doing with you and share my story, you know, because, you know, you got to realize not only was I a Bible college graduate, I worked on the newspapers, the magazine, the Angleite, the famous prison magazine. I was on staff for 12 years. So I wrote for the Angleite, and then I was a mentor. I went missionary. That's another thing. You know, Warden Kane would send those of us who graduated from the Bible college out to other prisons to be missionaries. So I did that. So, and then I also got to work on the cattle operation. You know, so I learned the cattle operation. But everywhere I worked, bivocational or whatnot, it was a ministry. I also got to go on the street. In Mayfly, I used to travel speaking at all kind of churches, as well as every now and then, Warden Kane then would allow me to go back on my tools. I had a lot to offer. You know, with tools, I could fix anything. So they were remodeling the old deaf school in Baton Rouge and turning it into the Prison Enterprise new headquarters, where Miss Natalie's office and Secretary LeBlanc, where their office was. So I would get dropped off on Mayflower Street, and I worked all day, and they would pick us up and bring us back to the prison. So here I am with a 40-year sentence, you know, being able to leave the prison, you know, and go work, at, you know, in a public place, you know, on my with tools, with a tool bag on me, you know, and handing out tracts, praying. And look, we could see the governor's building through one of the windows on the second floor, and we'd pray. We had legislation. Little did I know. I mean, that's how, remember I said, when was my out date? 2034. I'm sitting here on Zoom with you in 2023. You know, so legislation's gone on. And so, you know, just, you know, God working all this together. And then, you know, me and my brother, you know, my brother had turned against me. And very rightly so. But a miracle happened with that. Something real crazy. Has another, you're about to say crazy. One of the men decided that they, you know, Kyle, you know, you've got 13 years in. This is 2013. They said, let's go ahead and put a motion together and maybe try to get maybe a reconsider, maybe get some of your time cut. And I'm like, I'm not worried about a time cut. I'm guilty. They said, look, man, just let's give it a shot. Stop being so prideful. You know, they knew how to get to me, too, because really, okay, you know, I really do want to get home to my son. You know, I deserve to do the whole 40 years. I never had a problem with that. Devin, I never had a bad day in prison. Prison truly became a little bit of heaven on earth. I love pouring my life into other people. And you read about, you know, my next little piece of this talk is evident of that, of what I do today. You know, so nothing's changed. I just get to come home, you know. So I said, okay. So they put a motion together, and St. Bernard accepts it. So in 2015, I get to go back to St. Bernard and try to get a time cut. And my brother's there. Well, little did I know, my brother
Your brother is in the jail.
He's in the courtroom. In the courtroom. He's in the courtroom. Yeah, yeah. In the courtroom, he shows up to go against my release. He don't want me home. But I'm trying to figure out why. Well, what happened was that I didn't know about was that here in Louisiana, there's no forced heirship, meaning if you don't have a will, you can lose your property. So everything I owned, my brother was able to forge his signature to become attorney. Used my mother's hand. Nobody knew this. I found out all this later because he admitted to me, and I'm about to get to that. So he didn't want me out to fight that. He sold everything. I mean,
oh my God. Okay, crazy. That's crazy, yeah. Number three.
Yeah, we got a couple more crazies. So, but I had a choice here. Forgive or fight him through the court system. My heart is always bent about sharing his gospel, an opportunity to sit down and love on someone. Jesus forgave me. Look at everything I've done. I don't deserve any of that. I'm not entitled to any of that. Man, God became a man and died for me because of love. So how much more should I? My God owns everything. I'm just a good steward of everything he's given me. So my heartbeat was to forgive my brother because had I fought him through the legal system, Devin, I would have never had an opportunity to share the gospel with him.
And that takes like 30 years. Quite 30 years, but that's
I'm not coming home anyway. You know, I'm in prison, you know. I would have hoped that he would have given the stuff to the kids. You know, he's got kids. So, and I got my son. And I got my daughter, Kaylin, you know. So, but I forgive him. So at the court, he done went to the DA, don't let Kyle out. He gonna kill me. Okay, you know, so the judge denies, after granting me to come in there for a hearing, denies the time cut. And so when we're done, I thank my attorney, hug her. I'm a trustee, so I don't have the black boxes like that. You know, I can kind of hug people. I turn around, Devin, my brother's sitting right behind me. I didn't even know he's behind me. But it gets better than that.
I should have a button that says crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy. But it gets better. There's the church people who's there for me on my side. But there's a conversation I found out between Pastor Robbie and my brother before I get there in court. Pastor Robbie is another pastor. I had Pastor Larry, who is the pastor at Riverside Baptist Church, where I live today, and I'm on staff, you know, where I help out. And then there's Pastor Robbie, who ministered to me, who's from Slidell, who was one of the churches that helped get my son from Florida to Angola to visit with me. But he brought his congregation to my hearing to support me. Well, I didn't realize that Pastor Robbie and my brother went to Chalmette High School together. They were friends. So when they pull up, Robbie sees my brother and says, "Hey, John, how you doing?"
Oh, my
Bobby's
God.
Not even connecting that. That's my brother. They don't, you know. Yeah, it's crazy. God is sovereign. Talking about working all things out. So, man, how you doing, John? I hadn't seen you in years. Man, what's up? You got a ticket or something? He's asking my brother. My brother said, "No, I'm in here to keep my brother Kyle Hebert in prison." Pastor Robbie says, "That's crazy. I'm here to get him out." And then Robbie tells him, "John, it sounds like you got some unforgiveness in your heart." Robbie begins ministering to my brother and sharing everything. My brother had no idea in those 15 years what the Lord had been doing in my life. And my brother, his heart was prepared that when I turned around after being denied, crying, I hugged my brother, and I was able to whisper in his ear, "I love you. Please forgive me. I forgive you. I'm not worried about, I just want you in my life." And it was from that day, Devin, that I began writing my brother, calling my brother, being a part of my brother's life, reading scriptures with him, and involving him in the life of my mentees, because I would teach Celebrate Recovery, Experiencing God, Victim Awareness, Malachi Dads, all these programs that I went through, I was now giving it back to the men in Angola, and we would write letters to my brother. I always would let these men know what I was doing in my life to encourage them. So I'm, you know, the Lord had reconciled me and my brother back. So I wanted them to be a part of that, because of them had brothers and sisters and mamas and dad and children that they wasn't talking with. Again, I don't have Caleb, but I'm believing the Lord's going to work all that out or not. I mean, that's strictly up to him. But I love my daughter. I'll never stop praying for my daughter. I will never stop being there. Matthew loves his sister, you know, but that's a whole nother story. And I got two granddaughters. I got a granddaughter, Mackenzie, and I got a grandson, Monty. And then I've got a bonus son, Troy, her husband. None of them are in my life. But I'm believing the Lord will put them back in my life one day. That's strictly up to him. But me and my brother reconciled, and for 2 years, I was closer with my brother through letters, phone calls, and I never got to visit with him, but I was able to love on my brother. I was closer with him than I ever was in person. So, 2017, I get a tap on the shoulder from Warden Easley and says, go see the chaplain. Now, I know, Devin, what that means. Being an inmate minister for all those years, normally, when you have to go see a chaplain, it's a death message. So I run upstairs, and sure enough, Chaplain St. Cyr hands me the telephone. It's my niece, my brother's oldest daughter, Jamie. She says, Uncle Kyle. I said, oh my God, how you doing, Jamie? I hadn't spoken to Jamie. Now, Jamie's in my life today. We text almost every day. At least once a week, her and I are texting. I got my niece in my life. Jamie says, I'm so sorry, Uncle Kyle, but my daddy's dead. And I'm like, what happened? She's like, and how did you know to call me here? I hadn't been in touch with Jamie. Here's another crazy coming. She says, I went by his house to check on him. He lived by himself. Because her mom and my brother had divorced. And she said, when he didn't answer the door, I used the key to go in. And when I went upstairs, I found him laying on the ground, dead, not breathing. But I saw your letters on his bed. And I saw that you had been in communication with my daddy. So I called Angola. That's how I knew where you were. There's the crazy. Now it's really fixing to get crazy.
I'm going to stop this episode.
God is sovereign. So Devin, I immediately asked Chaplain St. Cyr to call Warden Fontenot, who is one of my very close wardens. I was close with many wardens because I worked for so many of them. Warden Fontenot was over the Angleite when Cheryl Renata moved on to be the pardon board chairwoman. My original boss became over the pardon parole board. We're going somewhere. Just be cool. My boss is running it. Now look. God is sovereign. So look, she says, I'm already on it, Kyle. Warden Fontenot had already arranged for me to be at the funeral the next day. So they drive me all the way back to St. Bernard. That's a nice run from Angola. About a 2.5-hour drive. Trustee, you know, I'm in street clothes. And look, all I got. I got my Bible. This is the Bible right here in the back of the police car. We're going to St. Bernard to my brother's funeral. There's cars everywhere when we pull in. So the guards tell me, Kyle, just go ahead and walk in. We'll meet you in there. I'm a statewide trustee. You know, I walk around without guards. I don't need someone. I mean, I done worked, you know, on Mayflower Street. Highly trusted. But my family doesn't know that. Not everyone. There's a couple that have heard, but here I come walking in the front door of the parlor where my brother's, you know, where the funeral's being held in St. Bernard. They see me walk in. They like, oh my God, did he escape? What's going, how did he get here? And I got a Bible in my hand. Last time they saw me, I had a 40-ounce beer, you know. My family's like, what in the world? So I pop up. Well, let me tell you, that whole day, I was able to apologize to my whole family. Some received it, some didn't. But I was able to reconcile and reconnect with, like, my cousin Ellis. You know, who is in my life now, you know, and I got to see my cousin Andre. I don't really talk to them that much. I love them. I love my family. They, even if they don't love me, I love my family, you know, but here's the crazy. My brother on paper was a professing Catholic. Okay. But if you don't attend church the priest won't come do your funeral. Devin, nobody was there to do my brother's funeral. So who do you think does my brother's funeral? I did my brother's funeral. And my whole family's there like, oh my God. And so I was able to share the scriptures. And while there, my nephew stands up and says, I love Jesus. I want to renounce my sins right now and ask for forgiveness. So in the preaching of the word, where there was death, life came. And my nephew, John, you know who, let me tell you something, who theoretically a mini me, you know, he's been through his drug addiction. Matter of fact, he's done a little prison time and everything, but he received Jesus that day as his Lord and Savior, and through the preaching of the gospel while I was there. So miracle after miracle, crazy after crazy, and we got.
I swear we need a crazy button. I'm not even gonna say. I'm just gonna push it right now.
And here's the. No, I think we got two more crazies. Miss Natalie, the one that brought Lisa Harper, and we got to hang out. You know, I got to meet her, and she brought Ravi Zachariah, but that's how she got there. And this is way before he got in trouble. But Miss Natalie, they're litigating to try and, you know, Warden Kane and Secretary LeBlanc, who is all about rehabilitation and preparing men where there's no more victims. They work out a parole project is another thing where it's a transition house and a group of men that come out of prison. They're all litigating this Act 122. Now, remember, my out date is 2034, but they litigate this Act 122 that in August of 2021, it becomes a law, and it allows me, who has a 40-year sentence, non-sexual, you know, if it's a sex offender, it doesn't fit them. But for violent crimes, if you have 30 or more years, set numbers, you're allowed you must serve 20 years and be at least age 45 to have a parole eligibility. Don't mean you'll make it. Because your prison jacket, your body of work, your disciplinary and all that must be where they want it in order to be a low risk to be released. Well, remember, I got 98 arrests, 5 felony convictions, but I went from that to being 0 disciplinary infractions, Master of Divinity, teaching, traveling. Yeah, I mean, a lot of something happened, and we know that it was because of Jesus removing the heart of stone, replacing it with a heart of flesh, giving me a new spirit, new desires. I begin to hate the things I used to love, and I now love the things I used to hate, namely God and people, and then studying his word and giving it away. So the people saw that, and so I get a new rap sheet with a parole eligibility date on it under Act 122. I couldn't believe what I was looking at when they handed it to me. So in December of 2021, I went on, Miss Natalie made a way that I would get to go on the first board. And not only did I make the board, they kicked me out of Angola on the 17th. I wound up coming out here to Denham Springs, where I'm now part of the church that used to come in Angola. I'm on staff. I was able to transition through Parole Project. My former editor of the Angolite, Kerry Myers, and dear friend of mine, Andrew Huntley, who was the first juvenile after serving 20-some odd years, was able to come out of prison. Kerry Myers, who had done 30-some odd years in Angola, he got out on the pardon board where Cheryl Renatza was our boss for the Angolite. She's now the chairwoman. She got to witness all of this. And Kerry did 31 years as an innocent man and is now out here giving back. So I got to go through the parole project. And then the Lord blessed me with church members from Riverside. They blessed me with a home. They blessed me with a car. And then Sheriff Ard, who is the sheriff of Livingston Parish, he and Warden Ben Ballard and Mark Carroll, who is the lead chaplain, came and spoke with me and asked me to come aboard as the reentry chaplain. So today, I now work, can you see that, for the Sheriff's Department here in Livingston Parish, doing the same thing I was doing in Angola. The only difference is I get to leave the jail every day. So that's that, two more that, crazies.
That must be nice.
And yeah, I spent 6 hours at a time with the guys. So yeah, I was able to do my brother's funeral. Then I was able to make parole. Then I went through parole project. And then I live out here in Denham Springs in a wonderful old couple's mom's house that used to be, you know, Dave Tate's mom. And, you know, I'm blessed here. And they got cattle. They got cattle here, so I get to see the cattle. And I go to the jail 3 days a week. I get to go to the church. And, you know, I'm able, you know, when needed, teach and preach. And got a wonderful community around me that has loved on me and welcomed me. And I get to share what the Lord's doing. It's like I got to share what the Lord has done in my life here with you this morning, Devin. And my son is now a senior at Wheaton College. He's at, you know, Manny Mill brought in Wheaton College. And I made a lot of the Lord open up doors. It's all about connections. And, you know, we depend on God, but we have interdependency on each other, the body of Christ. And he'll make a way. He's no respecter person. What he's done for me, he'll do for anybody. My mess is his message. He gave me new desires. I'm sorry for all the ones that I have hurt and harmed, and I can't change that. I wish I could. But he's used every bad decision for his glory. And I sit here today, a man who, number one, thinks of others' interests more important than himself. And I'm grateful. And the Lord's blessed me. I've been home now for 20 months. And I have been celibate for 24 years. I'm, you know, 22 and some change. And then the 20 months out here, I'm truly living for the Lord, waiting for the Lord to send me my Eve, you know, and if that's even in his will, you know, I love, you know, that's, it's about purity and honoring women and valuing women and honoring God and not being, you know, idolatry. And, you know, these are things that I not only preach and teach, I live. And am I perfect? No. But I serve a perfect God. I stand positionally perfect because of the finished work of Christ. And, yes, I'm practically raggedy, but I'm a son, and I do go through chastising. And thank God I do, because that is the litmus test that proves that I'm a son. You know, he said, in the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I've overcome the world. How did he overcome it? He rose from the dead. We serve the only God that there's no bones in the tomb. And that same God that rose Jesus from the dead is the same God that resides in me. And I'm grateful. So let me drop the mic. All glory to Jesus. Devin, you are precious. Love you. And thank you for this. You need to get my phone number so we can text one another and I can start sending you scripture.
Yeah. I almost hesitate to ask you this, but is there anything you would like to ask before we get off here?
You've been so precious. I told the whole story. I don't think I left anything out. You know, I'm grateful for Riverside Baptist. I'm grateful for all the Southern Baptist churches down here, all the Reformed Baptist churches, you know, here in Livingston and, you know, throughout Louisiana, you know, they've opened up their doors and allowed, you know, man, there's so many, you know, that they've opened their doors and allowed me to tell my story. It's like I got you, you know, this morning, you know, to tell my story and just glorify God. It's not about Kyle. This is not about Kyle Hebert. It really isn't. This is all about Jesus and his saving grace. And if he saved a wretch like me, he'll save anybody. Be of good cheer. Look, you're in good hands. Paul said that he was the worst of sinners. You know, he and I are going to have a talk when we get to heaven. I think, no doubt, I'm the worst. Yeah, you know, so, but anyway, I'm not, you know, it's, it's not a game. It's all about Jesus, and I'm humbled. He broke me inside the confines of my consequences, and he made a way inside of the land of new beginning. And he equipped me. He had been equipping me all the way, even in the fire, equipping me. You know, I had an amazing, the Lord blessed me with an amazing cell block ministry where I could go to TU. That's where you got a lot of mental health. I would go to the disciplinary areas in Angola, Camp J. I would go to Death Row, which is Life Row. You know, we had programs there. But a lot of the guys who were part of the, you know, in the various, you know, gangs and whatnot would accept me, but they would see the, you know, Jesus in me. They knew my consistent morality, you know, because it's truly, you know, you can't fake it in prison because you got eyes on you all day long. And let me tell you, if you fake this, they don't want nothing to do with you. But if you real about your faith, which it's not even about me, it's about the Lord guiding me and dying daily and allowing him to work in and through me. You know, there was a consistency and still is. Now that I'm home, this I'm done deal. You know, it's all about Jesus. I go back into prison and look, experiencing God. I'm teaching on Monday. On Wednesday, I do Celebrate Recovery. And then on Fridays, I'm doing Victim Impact and Malachi Dads. The same programs I was doing in Angola, I'm doing in Livingston Parish Detention Center. And it's a legit DOC CTRP 90-day good time class. They get 90 days for taking my class. And it's not even about the good time. It's truly about no more victims. It's teaching these men to operate in the role of prophet, priest, and king of their household, just like I did with my sons. So I was able to bring home all the DVDs and everything because being in the Angolite, I could film everything I was doing. So now I just bring it to the prison and put it in a DVD player, and they get to see everything I was doing in Angola.
Which is, God, like,
yeah.
How, literally, I do not know how we're going to top this episode. I have to go because I have an appointment at 2, so I need to make sure to get ready. But thank you so, so much. We have to do a part 2.
God bless you. I'm honored. I'm gonna send you my telephone number on your email.
Okay. I might just keep the email going for a while, but
Yeah. I just wanted that way, I mean, if you want to call, you can call, and I send text messages out ministering to people. Yeah. I want you to have that. You can call me anytime. That's what I'm saying.
Family. Okay, I will keep that in mind. But thank you. I literally do not know how we're gonna top this. I hope I win some kind of award for this. No, I'm joking.
Just let God get the glory.
I literally don't know how we're gonna top this, but we will try next week. See you guys next episode. Bye, guys.
God bless you, Devin. Thank you. Praying for you.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to follow the show and our guests on social media and subscribe to the show on YouTube or in your favorite podcast app using the links in the show notes. If you're listening on the podcast app, please remember to rate and review us. See you next time.